The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You're listening to our first attempt to keep an audio journal of our trip through the south of England and then across the channel to Normandy, down around Paris for the Pentecost weekend, and then back through England on our way home next week. So today, we're recording this on Wednesday, June the 5th, and we're in Portsmouth, which is at the southern tip of England. And we had this trip planned, a month or two ago, because we wanted to come down here and see HMS Victory, Lord Nelson's famous ship from the Battle of Trafalgar. But then we come to find out later that this is also a pretty historic site with respect to Normandy, the D-Day landing from 75 years ago. So there's right now, even as I'm recording this, there's a huge, huge celebration going on. You can hear some battleships firing in the port here. And just above us, we've got some planes flying through, some World War II era planes that are flying right through as this celebration goes on. Donald Trump is here, the President of the United States. You've got Angela Merkel. You've got pretty much every Western leader is here right now in Portsmouth. So before seeing the HMS Victory, we're going to be finishing off our time here at Portsmouth. So it was pretty amazing. We got as close as we could get. Basically, they've got it's an outdoor facility, and so they've got the stage area cordoned off with fencing. But this is called South Sea Common, and they let the general public come in to the common area just behind the fence. And then there's all kinds of big screens that have broadcasted the event live. So we basically were just sitting on the grass and watching the event, listening to a lot of speeches, a lot of music, as you just heard there. And then, the event, it culminates in this flyby with some of these World War II era aircraft. And then, as you heard, the cannons going off in the port facility. So it's been pretty amazing, all in all. I'll just let some of the background sound continue as you listen to our first audio journal. This is the first day of our trip, June 5th, 2019. And we're here in Portsmouth for the first time. And what we plan to do is to just touch bases with you throughout this weekend so that you can get a feel for some of the sites that we've been able to see. And we'll also try our best to tie it into some of the current events. Like I said, we heard a lot of world dignitaries speak today. So we'll maybe later on this evening or tomorrow morning, we'll try to cut in some highlights from the speeches, and I think we might have even recorded some of it from the big sound system here ourselves. But I'm sure there'll be clips available on YouTube and such, so we'll definitely spice things up. And right now we've got four jets flying right over the top of us. It's hard to estimate the crowd size down here, but certainly there's many thousands of people out here in the South Sea Common watching the event on video. Just inside the enclosure, you probably have a couple thousand people, world leaders, World War II veterans, all kinds of people that participated in the ceremony. Two more jets flying over just now. The ceremony was really concentrated on just telling the story of D-Day, but it also just kind of summarized some of the events leading up to it, how the U.S. got involved. President Trump, when he came on board, here comes quite a few more jets. When during the ceremony they talked about the United States entering into the war, they referred to this famous prayer that President Roosevelt gave, seeing our sons off across the Atlantic to help liberate Europe. And so this famous prayer, it was President Trump who then came on stage and recited that that prayer.
In 1942, support and resources arrived on a staggering scale when from across the pond, the American contingent rallied. Over 1.5 million men left the USA, bidding farewell to life as they knew it, to coffee, to baseball, and to loved ones. With photographs folded in pockets, they traveled halfway across the world to join the pursuit of freedom. During a radio message, President Roosevelt led the nation in a prayer that will be forever remembered by the American people. The President of the United States.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. They will need thy blessings, for the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteous of our cause, our sons will triumph. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, the heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee. Faith in our sons, faith in each other, and faith in our united crusade. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
Really an inspiring ceremony. We've been focusing so much of late on history, and the history is certainly on display in the South Sea Common. Right here in Portsmouth, they're wrapping up the festivities right now with this symphony orchestra that's up on stage. So an exciting beginning to our 5 or 6 day trip, just in looking around the common area. This is like a park right on the harbor in Portsmouth, and in looking at some of the buildings surrounding this this park area, this common area, you can see some Secret Service agents at the top of one structure. You can see cameramen that are way up above on cranes so that this the ceremony could be broadcast. I would imagine it's on live TV here in the UK. I'm not sure how it's playing throughout the rest of the world. In any event, our plan is to give you periodic updates throughout our trip, and as I say, also to spice things up with maybe some excerpts from the ceremony. So later on today, we're going to be seeing the HMS Victory, Lord Nelson's famous battleship from Trafalgar. So with that, we'll say goodbye until we touch bases with you again.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Why did Great Britain have such a positive influence on the world? Was it because Britain was just better? Were the British inherently more powerful and more equitable? Great Britain spread not only its language, but advancements in agriculture, industry, science, commerce, banking, infrastructure, education, and the list goes on. Entire nations, great nations, have their common law and their representative governments because of the influence of Great Britain. The empire served its own interests, to be sure, but it also advanced its beliefs. It spent much of its treasure, its sailors, its soldiers, and its lives to fight slavery and to rid the world of barbarous practices. Not always because it was economical, but because it was right. Where did those beliefs come from? What were those laws based on? Some may argue that they're just common sense. Some may say that the British are, or were, inherently a better people. Britain's laws were better. Its virtues were better. But not because its people were naturally better. It's because of what Britain's laws were based on. British law traces back beyond the Empire. It traces back beyond England, Scotland, Wales, or Ireland. It traces back through Britain's earliest ancestors. This heritage reaches back not hundreds of years, but thousands of years. It links directly back to a surprising yet familiar source. The virtues and laws of Great Britain don't trace back to a few philosophers and theorists scattered across the past few centuries. They aren't the result of impersonal forces and random historical texts. They trace back to one source. That source was an absolutely perfect law and government. And through the centuries and the millennia, the tighter Britain has clung to that source, the better its laws have been. Understanding that source explains where and why our British ancestors succeeded, and where and why they failed. And more to the point, it explains what we today so sorely lack. To find out where British culture originated, read Britain's 4,000-year-old history. This book is adapted from The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. That book was read by 6 million people around the world, far more than a Times bestseller. Request Britain's 4,000-year-old history and prove the identity and future of Britain for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
So we have moved on from the common area where we saw the June 5th ceremonies earlier this morning. This afternoon, we've been at the historic dockyard in Portsmouth, and this is where the HMS Victory is dry docked, and it's just across the way from the British aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, which is a massive ship, and we actually took a little bit of a tour through the harbor on one of the ferries for about 45 minutes, and there's quite a few naval ships that are in commission, including the HMS Victory. The HMS Victory is the oldest commissioned warship in the world. Construction of this began back in the 1750s. Then it was commissioned in 1778. So it's right around the time of the Revolutionary War for you Americans. And it's still the official flagship of the first Sea Lord. Of course, it's famous for the Battle of Trafalgar, which was in October of 1805. And that's really an incredible story. We read about some of that in Andrew Roberts' book on Napoleon. But you had Napoleon and his armies dominating the continent. But right at that time, it was the British who were dominating the sea. And with respect to that particular battle, the British were outnumbered. They were facing a combined French-Spanish fleet of 33 ships compared to 27 British Royal Navy ships. And Nelson signaled to his fleet from the HMS Victory, "England expects that every man will do his duty." In the battle, the French and Spanish fleet lost 22 ships, and the British lost one. Or no, rather, the British lost none. It was an overwhelming victory. But as you historians know, they did lose their beloved Admiral Nelson. And he was out at the front. We were walking through the ship, and one of the tour guides there was explaining what happened when he was out on the deck. He was wearing his full naval attire, very colorful, and of course his distinctive hat, and he was picked off by one of the sharpshooters on one of the French vessels. And so he got shot through the shoulder, and it went down. The bullet lodged in his spine, and they took him below deck where he was basically paralyzed. He was still awake and alert for about 3 hours before he died. So when we took a tour of this ship, we saw the spot where he was shot. We saw his quarters, his living quarters, and we also saw where he died a few hours into the battle. He did learn that they had won the battle before he died. So pretty amazing history and a victory for Britain that really cemented Britain's rule of the waves, and it killed off all of Napoleon's goals to invade Britain and to dominate the sea. This victory also established Horatio Nelson as Britain's greatest ever naval hero. Trafalgar Square, of course, the iconic square in the middle of London, that was created in 1835 to commemorate the battle. And then later after that, the Nelson Column that was erected in Admiral Nelson's honor in 1843. I have a quote here from, I think this is from History Explorer, something that one of the gals was able to track down for me. It says here, when Victory was built in the 1750s and 60s, Britain was one of a number of nations harboring ambitions of becoming the world's dominant naval power. It says by the time she was retired half a century later, few could doubt that Britain, not France or Spain, was well on its way to achieving that goal. So Victory's story, it says, is also the story of Britain's emergence as an imperial heavyweight, it says, and it is her role at Trafalgar, the battle, that secured this preeminence that makes her the most celebrated of all Royal Navy warships. And so they're doing everything they can to refurbish this ship as it's weather-worn, and they're repainting it and replacing some of the wood that rots out and stuff. We, again, heard some of this from a couple of the guides on the ship. One last point that I'll just leave you with, this from another article on the internet, just talking about Lord Nelson's offensive mindset. It says here, 6,000 Frenchmen and Spaniards were killed or wounded at Trafalgar, as well as 1,700 Britons. It says 19 enemy ships were taken and sunk, but the immensity of the victory at Trafalgar transcended such mundane calculations. It says it guaranteed British control of the oceans and the creation of a unique global power that would endure for more than a century. So this was right at the time when God began to pour out his blessings upon Ephraim. Of course, Manasseh secured the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, and then Britain comes away with this stunning victory at Trafalgar in 1805, guaranteeing Britain control of the ocean, creating this global power. It says here, Nelson was the greatest warrior that Britain ever produced. The unchallenged master of war at sea remains a vital part of British national identity. It says a refuge in times of crisis, the inspiration for bold and decisive action. It says his name and example filled the rhetoric of that other great Briton, Winston Churchill, through the darkest days of the Second World War. Further on in this article, it says, Nelson viewed war on the grandest scale. He saw battle not as an end in itself, but as a means of advancing wider national aims. And so it was on that day, or in October 1805, that he was, as I said earlier, shot and killed. I think he was he was 47 years of age at that time. And of course, if you've visited London, you're familiar with Trafalgar Square, you're familiar with the Nelson Column. But if you get a chance, definitely drive an hour and a half or so south to Portsmouth so that you can also see HMS Victory. We're on the next stop of our audio journal. You've heard from us at the South Sea Common earlier today with all of the D-Day ceremonies. And then after that, we went to the historic dockyard to see the HMS Victory, as well as lots of other ships and things in the harbor. And traveling with me right now, as it is, we're on the Brittany Ferry. We're going from Poole, England, to Cherbourg, France. It's an overnight ferry, and one of the things that I'm really excited about is that we'll be crossing the channel through the night and on into June the 6th, 2019, which is the 75-year anniversary of the D-Day landings. So we've got five of us traveling together on this enjoyable little excursion. I'm here with my wife, Amy, my son, Jude, and also helping us out, Parker Campbell, one of our AC students, and also Daniel DeSanto. So a few comments here before we hit the sack. What are some of your impressions on the first day of activity? Parker.
Yes, thank you. Well, I think that is very positive overall. The weather was very enjoyable, and we started off with the South Sea Commons, going over there and seeing the ceremonies first for D-Day, and it was really, really wonderful just to see the positivity among the crowd, among everybody that was there. Everybody seemed very enthusiastic and happy to be there, and so the day was very beautiful, and so far it's gone very well.
Yeah, it seems like we worked in a lot. It's hard to believe we left Edstone early this morning. But with all the things that we've seen, it feels like we've packed 2 or 3 days' worth of activities into one day. What about you, Daniel? What's some of your impressions from the day?
Today really made some great history come alive, because it's one thing to hear about the veterans, their experiences, their stories from the war, but it's another thing to actually talk to them. And we talked to a couple of them. There's one from Vietnam we met today, and there is one from World War II even, who worked in the radio division and was essentially working to fool the Germans and to make them think that they were going to invade, the Allies would invade in a separate, in a different place than they actually did.
How about you, love? Are you enjoying it with all these gentlemen?
I sure am.
Anything else? Anyone? Anything else?
One of the things that stood out to me was there was so much patriotism today, and we don't usually see that, but I think the event just drew a patriotic crowd.
Right, and at South Sea Common, as I said earlier in one of our segments, there were thousands of people, and when President Trump was announced, he came out and gave that reading from FDR's prayer back during World War II. They all clapped for him. Nobody booed for him. And also, as we were walking our way through Portsmouth, we didn't see one protester. In fact, we saw people out there with kind of holding up their towels and flags in support of the United States and Donald Trump. So that was unexpected, I guess, given what the news media continually says. Jude, what are your thoughts?
We saw some MAGA hats, and I was not expecting to see that from the British public. As if in America, you would not expect to see political slogans in support of Theresa May or something. So that was unusual and unexpected, and also I thought was nice to see from the British public that really hasn't been supportive of President Trump up to this point.
All right, and Love, you had one more?
It was also nice to see people honoring their queen like they did. They stood up and they clapped and whistled for her, and it was just really nice to see.
Yeah, Yeah, every major Western leader was there. We didn't realize it was going to be this big of a ceremony. But every major Western leader, and then the royal family, Queen Elizabeth with Prince Charles. And then, as she just said, when Queen Elizabeth came in, she came in last. And then she had a short speech during the ceremony as well. And, yeah, they all stood up immediately. So, in any event, we'll get back to you tomorrow when we try to see if we can get through the blockade that's going to be around the Normandy beaches. So, hopefully we'll have some opportunities to get up close to the American Cemetery and some of the other sites. So we'll see you in the next segment.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. To those who followed the broadcasts and writings of Herbert W. Armstrong throughout his long ministry, and who still remember, world events today are an electrifying endorsement of the power of biblical revelation. Much of Mr. Armstrong's forecasting was proven accurate within his own lifetime, but since his death in 1986, events are proving him right all the more. For a comprehensive review of Mr. Armstrong's analysis, request our free booklet, He Was Right. He Was Right summarizes many of the Bible-based prophecies Mr. Armstrong proclaimed for more than 50 years. This booklet takes you back to the spiritual roots of the Philadelphia Church of God and the Trumpet magazine. To assemble the material in this booklet, our staff looked back through decades of old plain truth issues, looking for Mr. Armstrong's bold predictions. We then matched those prophetic statements with what actually happened or is now happening on the world scene. The result was amazing. The sheer number of prophetic statements made by Mr. Armstrong and his editorial team and their accuracy will astound you. The world may scoff, but Herbert Armstrong was right. Just how right is daily becoming apparent as we teeter on the brink of catastrophic global events that will lead to the greatest geopolitical intervention of all time, the return of Jesus Christ to this war-torn, war-weary earth. To order our free booklet, email your request to td@kpcg.fm. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
The next stop on our audio journal, Utah Beach, here on D-Day, the 75th anniversary. It was quite an ordeal, actually. I mentioned in the last segment that we spent the night on a ferry, which was a really exciting component to the trip, just crossing the channel on the night of the 5th of June through to the early morning hours of the 6th. And we landed in Cherbourg, which is about an hour from Normandy, or the beaches of Normandy. And I think we got about maybe 40 minutes down the road before we reached a checkpoint that had the road completely blocked off. And so we took about a 12-mile detour and came back, and then I think in the course of maybe two and a half hours, we must have come upon 7-8 checkpoints, all of them turning us away, until we finally got to one lady who said that if we went a certain way, we could get in to Utah Beach. We were hoping to go to Omaha Beach and to see the American Cemetery, but because of all the dignitaries, all the ceremonies going on all through the day, the security here is just unbelievable. So anyhow, we've salvaged the day and had a really wonderful time here at the Utah Beach. Right now we're on the beach, we're on Utah Beach, and this was quite a bit easier for the United States to gain control of back on June 6th, 1944. It was headed up by Brigadier General Teddy Roosevelt Jr., who famously said, I guess their crew or all of their landing craft drifted off course because of the winds by about a mile or two. And it worked out in their favor because the German armaments weren't quite as strong right here at Utah Beach. So he landed on this beach and then famously said, well, this is where we'll we'll start the war. And then I think it was, we went through the museum here, and I think it took just about an hour for them to gain control of the beach. So not near as many casualties as over at Omaha Beach. All in total, I think it was something like 6,000 landing craft and ships and other vessels carrying something like 175,000 troops that left from southern England and that landed on these five beaches. Ahead of their arrival, of course, there were thousands of aircraft that were bombing these locations just to clear the way for the 175,000 U.S. troops. So while we were here, besides seeing the museum, we were able to walk along the beach, and they had one ceremony here that was, I don't think there were any politicians in attendance, but there were, I think, four or five World War II veterans, and it kind of alternated between French and English through the course of this ceremony that lasted for about an hour. It looked like there were some pretty prominent military officials at the ceremony. In any event, we stood off to the side. It wasn't quite as exciting as the ceremony yesterday in Portsmouth, just because a lot of it was in French. But we did sit through about an hour of that. And then afterwards, the guys went against the stream, against the crowd as it was leaving. They made their way over to the World War II veterans. And then we came up, my wife and I came up a little bit later and saw Jude and Parker and Daniel surrounding this World War II veteran, and they were able to talk to him for several minutes. So here are a few highlights from their interview with this World War II veteran.
My name is Gene. The last name is Kleindl, as K-L-E-I-N-D-L. Klein in German is small. So I'm a small guy.
Yes, sir.
I'm from Rockford, Illinois, which is close to Chicago, about 100 miles.
What division did you serve under?
Well, you see that monument over there? That big one? That's a monument to the 9-0 division.
What did you say?
When in World War I, the 90th Division, the T-O stood for Texas, Oklahoma. In World War II, they changed it to Tough Armors.
What was your experience like on the beaches, sir?
Well, you see, war is a very slow, hardening thing. I remember lots of things that happened there. And some crazy things the officers were trying to do, being inexperienced. And being a medic, some of the people we picked up and brought in, so forth. In fact, we had one German guy who had a foot missing. I looked over at his face, he was laying on the litter, and he was done very nonchalant. Somebody stuck a cigarette in his mouth. And I thought, I would have been a little upset about that.
Yeah.
But went a little far and I realized that was a very small thing. He lost his foot. He was going home. The war was over. He was alive, see. That was important.
Just one more question, sir. How old are you?
I went at 20 years old. And how old do you think I am? Be careful. I got a birthday coming on the 23rd of June. I will be a big 9 and a big 7. 97. Can you imagine?
Congratulations.
Can you imagine me in 97? It's not easy being 97 because you can't race that off your mind when you're working. Because I do everything the same, almost. And then I say to myself, I shouldn't be doing that. Well, as long as that thing keeps ticking, I'm okay.
So that concludes our afternoon at Utah Beach on D-Day, the 75th anniversary. And that's about all the time that we have left. It's now Friday morning. We've made it to Paris. On our way here last night, we listened to President Trump's address from the American Cemetery yesterday, an inspiring address. I'd recommend listening to the whole thing if you wanted to get some good history and also just be moved to tears at a few points.
In any event, since we have some extra time before we have to ship this audio off to Ed Stone, and since there's some extra time left on the program today, we thought we would conclude this audio journal with an excerpt from President Trump's address on D-Day yesterday. Thanks for joining us on this audio journal, and we'll see you next week.
And finally, there were the Americans. They came from the farms of a vast heartland, the streets of glowing cities, and the forges of mighty industrial towns. Before the war, many had never ventured beyond their own community. Now they had come to offer their lives half a world from home. This beach, codenamed Omaha, was defended by the Nazis with monstrous firepower, thousands and thousands of mines and spikes driven into the sand so deeply. It was here that tens of thousands of the Americans came, the GIs who boarded the landing craft that morning knew that they carried on their shoulders not just the pack of a soldier, but the fate of the world. Colonel George Taylor, whose 16th Infantry Regiment would join in the first wave, was asked what would happen if the Germans stopped. Right then and there, cold on the beach, just stopped them. What would happen? This great American replied, "Why, the 18th Infantry is coming in right behind us. The 26th Infantry will come on too. Then there is the 2nd Infantry Division, already afloat, and the 9th Division, and the 2nd Armored, and the 3rd Armored, and all the rest. Maybe the 16th won't make it, but someone will." One of those men in Taylor's 16th Regiment was Army Medic Ray Lambert. Ray was only 23, but he had already earned 3 Purple Hearts and 2 Silver Stars fighting in North Africa and Sicily, where he and his brother Bill, no longer with us, served side by side. In the early morning hours, the two brothers stood together on the deck of the USS Henrico before boarding 2 separate Higgins landing craft. "If I don't make it," Bill said, "please, please take care of my family." Ray asked his brother to do the same. Of the 31 men on Ray's landing craft, only Ray and 6 others made it to the beach. There were only a few of them left. They came to the sector right here below us. Easy Red, it was called. Again and again, Ray ran back into the water. He dragged out one man after another. He was shot through the arm. His leg was ripped open by shrapnel. His back was broken. He nearly drowned. He had been on the beach for hours, bleeding and saving lives, when he finally lost consciousness. He woke up the next day on a cot beside another badly wounded soldier. He looked over and saw his brother Bill. They made it. They made it. They made it. At 98 years old, Ray is here with us today with his 4th Purple Heart and his 3rd Silver Star from Omaha. Ray, the free world salutes you.